Okay, ladies, let us begin today's Parsha. Parshas Re'eh, we're on page 998 in your Art Scroll Chumash. Okay, Parshas Re'eh is one of the many speeches as we go through Sefer Devarim that Moshe gives to the Jewish people in the last 5-6 weeks of his life. The entire Parsha is filled. We should just spend, again, it's the kind of Parsha, you don't need a shir, you just need to read the Parsha. The words themselves that Moshe gives us are so eloquent, they're so passionate, they're so meaningful themselves. It's impossible to summarize in any one shir. What I want to focus on this morning is one aspect which we really have not spent a lot of time on over the course of our years together going through the Parsha, and that is idolatry. Idolatry is mostly not relevant to our lives anymore today. We'll discuss a little bit in a moment why. But when the Jewish people entered into the land of Israel, it was very prominent in their lives. It was a major part of society and one of the most enticing aspects of life that was very hard to resist. And so there's a great deal of time that Moshe spends on the concept of idolatry. The Torah itself spends a lot of time on idolatry. And despite the fact that it's much less relevant in our lives, there are still a lot of interesting lessons to be learned from the way the Torah describes it. And let's go through some of that, since we often don't spend so much time talking about it. First of all, just as a word of introduction, why is it not so relevant in our lives anymore? The reason for that is the Gemara records, that it was so all-encompassing and so enticing and so powerful a drive that the Jews couldn't handle it anymore. And the sages, the Gemara records, actually prayed that the taiva, the desire, the yetzahara, the inclination towards idolatry should be abolished, because we just simply could not deal with it. You know, every person has a little desire for whatever vices they have. Some people, it might be for food. Men certainly have an issue with women, vice versa as well. There are taivas, there are drives, desires that people have for forbidden activities according to Torah law. And this one of idolatry, which we don't have anymore. Like, have you ever, like, walked past a church and said, oh, like, I really feel like I should stop and run in. It's pulling me. It's not part of most of our lives. And the Gemara requests, because they abolished the desire for idolatry, because we couldn't handle it.
The sages
of the Talmud prayed that it should be abolished, and it worked. In fact, the Gemara records, when they saw that it worked, they said, you know what, this is a good idea. Let's abolish the desire for illicit sexual relationships as well, because that also we're having trouble with, as has been the long story since the beginning of time. That's been a problem. So they prayed for that, and the Gemara says, so God said, fine, I'll take that away too. And the Gemara has very colorful language. The Gemara says within 3 days, they couldn't even find a chicken's egg throughout the entire land. That's how the Gemara describes. The Gemara has a very witty, colorful way of describing. So they said, okay, this is not going to work. That'll be the end of all of humanity. If there's no desire between men and women, you can't just have a complete blanket. So the Gemara says, so they prayed that it should be restored, which it has been very healthily restored, but not for immediate family, so that there's no desire for a mother to a child or siblings in the way, even though the drive is healthy and well and alive today. But for one's immediate family, there's just this very natural, in most situations, obviously we have diagnoses for situations that are not that way. Like, there's much less, almost none, for them. That's what they settled on, and that's how it is. But if you ever want to know what idolatry was like, so if you look out in the world and you read the newspapers and you read the stories of certain behaviors in the realm of illicit relationships, and you think, like, what were they thinking? So that's what it was like with idolatry. And you'd see somebody in terms of pagan beliefs or idolatrous beliefs, and if you don't have that desire, you look at it and you say, like, what? Why? What was the drive? Well, just think back to something that you do have an internal drive or desire for, and that used to exist for idolatry, but it no longer does. The Gemara records also, in its very colorful language, there was many of the stories of Tanakh and the Navi. Many of the kings of the Jewish people fell prey to idolatry, which was clearly a major issue throughout all of Navi, was the story of idolatry amongst the Jewish people. So one of the wicked kings, Menashe, who was an idolater, so one of the sages of the Talmud, who lived after this prayer to abolish the drive and desire for idolatry was studying the Navi and reading about this King Menashe who had become an idolater and made some not nice remark about this king who was an idolater. And the Gemara records that the king appeared to him, I don't remember if it says it in a dream or in a vision, whatever it was, and said, you know, you sit here speaking disparagingly about me and my generation. If you would have lived when I lived, a little guy like you, you're a nothing. Me, I fell prey to you. You would have been picking up the hems of your pants to run faster into the houses of ill repute, which in those days were idolatrous houses. You would have been running. You would have been first in line. So don't you sit here living after this abolishment and talk disparagingly about us who lived before. You don't understand what it was like. So we too do not understand what the drive for idolatry is. There are many commentators, modern day rabbis, who like to point out that our manifestation of idolatrous practice is where we also live for something else. Maybe money, prestige, honor. The idea of a Jew giving up himself or herself for some other goal, mission, purpose, rather than a godly Torah lifestyle, is also a form of giving oneself over. I know in this room of women, this is probably not so relevant, but if any of you have any male friends or family members who are sports addicts, or fans, which really just means fanatic, is a similar example that's often used, in which a person allows their emotional well-being to be determined by the bounce of a ball thousands of miles away. And whether or not you are depressed or elated or celebratory or like all of those things, like what are you doing? You're allowing your emotional well-being to be controlled by factors way out of your control that have nothing to do with you, and your time is taken up. I can't focus on anything right now. I'm busy with this. And the emotional being is also a form of, we won, is this idea of giving oneself, becoming part of something bigger. Not just being alone in this world. I'm part of something. And so, even though we don't really have idolatry in the sense of a deity, we don't have worship, but we certainly do have many things today that are applications or manifestations or iterations of the idea of giving yourself over to something bigger, different, that is all taking away from a Jew determining his or her own emotional state. Where are your values? Where do we place our goals and missions? What determines that when it's something from the outside? Those are all manifestations. Those are not real idolatry practices. Being a sports fan doesn't make you into an idolater. I'm just saying that those are all minor applications of it. The other application that we have today, I'll take questions and comments in a moment, is, which does come up very, not very often, but does come up, I even got a question just today, is about going to a church. This does come up not infrequently. It comes up when it comes to European history, people who like to travel, and there are many historical sites that are functioning churches. And there's, amongst the many times the Torah talks about idolatry, is not going into places of idolatrous practice. And Christianity, certainly Catholicism without question is idolatry. Many of the other forms of Christianity are big, big discussions in halacha. Do we consider them idolatrous? Do we not consider them idolatrous? It's a big discussion. The simple approach is we generally don't go to churches. You know, with leaving aside all of the Talmudic discussion about what determines what's considered idolatrous or not, in general, we don't go to churches, which creates serious questions when it comes to historical visits, as I mentioned, people wanting to go to certain sites, you're part of a tour. If it's a functional a church, we generally don't go in. It comes up in the States, certainly on election day, walking into churches to vote, where we're generally lenient as long as you're not walking into the sanctuary of the actual church, which most polling stations are not in the actual sanctuary, and everybody knows why you're there. But walking into a sanctuary is different, and it comes up. Many people have non-Jewish friends or colleagues at work who get married always in a church, and that creates major, major difficulties for the Jew. who, for whatever reason, wants to be able to support their friend or colleague, and it means walking into a sanctuary of a functioning church. It's not allowed. So as much as idolatry is not relevant in our daily lives in the sense of it's not a desire that we have to run to a church to serve other deities, we don't believe in them, we think it foolish. We look at most of the religion, there's no drive or desire to be part of it. In the Middle Ages, it was much more a part of daily life because of the nature of the world. The church was so powerful, a Jew couldn't do anything if he wasn't Christian. And so many Jews converted, some for theological reasons and some just because, you wanted to get ahead. You wanted to be a musician. You wanted to be a landowner. You wanted to be in education. There were certain things for many, many ages, not just from the Middle Ages, but all until much more recent times. It required becoming, so it was certainly always a part of our history. It's just, but in terms of our daily living, it's much less a part of the regular Jew today's daily existence. Doesn't really have it. But all that was a much longer introduction than I meant to do to the psukim we were going to learn about, which is about the idea of idolatry. Was there questions or comments?
I was just thinking of gambling when you were speaking of sports.
Gambling, meaning in the sense of what? Of a giving yourself, yeah, okay, but that's more of an addiction. Like sports is, as some people, I use the word addicted, but when I spoke about it, but it's the idea which ties into idolatry is not the addiction of it or the gambling part of it, is the becoming part of something larger. That idea. Listen, if anyone's been to an arena that's full. No comments about any of the local teams. If you're in a football stadium which holds 90,000 people, and there are 90,000 people screaming, yelling, cheering, rocking, there is an energy that is hard to recreate in another system. It's real that what sweeps through the stadium when 90,000 people. I mentioned this before, and the Siyum HaShas is going to be, the Daf Yomi is going to complete the cycle on January 1st, which is 7.5 years from the last one, which was, so the Aguda runs a major, major Siyum, and they rent out MetLife Stadium, which is where the New York football Giants and Jets play. It's right outside New York City. It's in New Jersey, actually, and it fits 90,000 fans. And I was at the last Siyum 7.5 years ago in the stadium. And when you, and they have more than 90,000 because they take the field is not the field. They actually have seating there on the field. There are nearly 100,000 Jews. And when 100,000 Jews say Shema together, when we daven Maariv, and 100,000 Jews answer Kaddish, it was awe-inspiring. You've never heard a stadium like the Kaddish right before Shemona and Marv is amazing. You know, Shema is unreal, and then Kaddish, and then silence for Shemona Esrei. 100,000 Jews screaming Yehei Shmei Rabba one moment, and then literally 10 seconds later, total silence during Shemona Esrei. It's an amazing experience. But outside of the 7.5 years that go by in between a Siyum HaShas, like when do you have a gathering like that other than every Sunday at football season, which is a totally different experience. But there's a power to that, the numbers of people who are unified in a goal. And that's what I mean when I talk about sports, more than just the addiction. Addiction, as you said, there are hundreds of thousands of, many addictions that a person can involve. Okay, all of that. A long, long introduction to our topic. Bottom line is I wanted to talk about two aspects. I hope we'll get to both of them, in which Moshe addresses idolatry in our parsha. One is in the very beginning of the parsha. Again, page 998. Parsha begins with Moshe telling us he's going to give us a bracha and klala, which is not relevant to our discussion today, that when we enter into the land of Israel, there will be blessings on Har Gerizim and on Har Eval, the two mountains, right when the Jews cross over. Half the tribes will stand on one mountain, half the tribes on the other mountain, and the various blessings and curses will be given, and that will cover, God willing, another year in greater depth. Pesukim that we're going to focus on begin on the bottom of page 998, Pasuk Beis, in the beginning of Perek Yud Beis, the 12th chapter. Torah describes in Pasuk Beis as follows: Abed ta'abdun. You ever see where I am? Abed ta'abdun as kolam mekamos. You must utterly destroy all the places where the nations of the world of Dusham Agoyim, where they worship their gods. where you're going to inherit, they worship their gods in those places. And where are you going to find the places where the nations that you're about to conquer? You're going to find them al haharim haramim. You're going to find them on the high mountains. You're going to find them al hagvaos, on the hilltops. You're going to find them tachas kol etz ranon, under every leafy tree, in all the nice beautiful spots, the upper mountains, the beautiful rolling hills, under the trees. That's where they set up their idolatrous practices, and you have an obligation of abed ta'abdun. You must utterly destroy all of those places where the idolaters had set up their avodah zarah. Vini tatztem, and that'll be very graphic language, Moshe says. In Pasuk Gimel, Vini tatztem es mizbechos sam. You will break apart their altars. Vishibartem es matzevos sam. You will smash their pillars. Vyashrehem tisrafun ba'esh. And their trees you will burn in the fire. Their carved images you will cut down. You will obliterate their name from that place. I think it was like five different phrases. Moshe is very graphic. If you needed a thesaurus, so like every time he says a different word, a different adjective, a different way of describing what you must do to smash, cut down, obliterate, burn, break apart. All the different things. I think the message goes without saying is pretty clear. What's the agenda? What's our goal?
Destroy.
Completely destroy and eradicate, eliminate even es shimam, the remembrance of their name. Rashi quotes that you're allowed to and should not even relate or refer to it by name, but you can use derogatory nicknames to refer to the various deities. So instead of calling the actual gods and religions that existed by their names, they would have the nicknames to refer to the different things. You'll find the manifestation of Kratzmuch. People, they don't even want to use the name of
JC,
Yoshka. All of that is a manifestation of this idea of the name shouldn't even be found on your lips of idolatrous practice. And so there are nicknames, and the Yiddish language had, I'm sure, plenty of various others that were used always to refer to religions and idolaters that were not actually used by name. That comes from Moshe, that you have to completely eradicate, completely destroy all of that. Now, that would be very simple. And it is very simple. And then the very next pasuk is, we're going to focus on the next pasuk. I want to read past it, but then we're going to go back to it. The next pasuk Dalet says, Loi ta'asun kein la Hashem Elokeichem, but do not do this to Hashem your God. Now, in the simple flow, it says, when you come into the land, utterly destroy all idolatrous practice. Smash, burn, obliterate, remove all practices. But do not do this to Hashem your God. Do not do what to Hashem your God? What do you think that is a reference to when it says, but do not do this to Hashem your God? Simple meaning, of course, would be obliterate, destroy. Which sounds like a little that's necessary. After describing, we're not just talking about not serving. We're saying obliterate, destroy, burn, remove, but don't do that to Hashem your God. So when the Rashi is going to give us three interpretations of what exactly that phrase means, difficult phrase. Let's just keep reading for a little bit. The next pasuk will give us a little bit of a hint as well. Ki im ala makom asher yivchar Hashem Elokeichem mikol shivteichem. Only in the place that Hashem will choose, lasum es shemo sham, to place His name there, that's the only place where you can serve Him and bring your offerings and incense, only not wherever you'd like. So the simple meaning would be, just like the nations of the world set up idols wherever they wanted, in every beautiful hilltop, mountaintop, under the tree, they did it wherever they wanted, you may not do that to Hashem, meaning that you, what is it that you may not do to Hashem, going all the way back to the opening phrase of setting up places of worship wherever you want, that you can't do. You can only do it in the place that He so chooses, in Yerushalayim, in the Beis HaMikdash. That's the only place that you're allowed to bring your offerings. L'shichno tidrishu uvasa shama. You will seek out His presence and come there. That phrase is a really beautiful phrase. L'shechno, l'shachen means as a neighbor, to dwell, the shechina, the divine presence. Tidrishu, seek it out. Which is always the message. In other words, when a person, if you want to find spirituality, and this is the epitome of spirituality, finding Hashem's presence itself. So what's the approach? Do you say, I'm waiting for it to come to me. When it hits me, I'll know it. Then I'll feel it. Or is it the obligation to go out and seek and find and search? And so this phrase, l'shechno tidrishu, you must be dorish it. You must seek it. You must find it. You always, I've said this many times, I'll repeat it again. If a person comes on Shabbos morning to the rabbi's sermon and says, you know, I'm waiting for the rabbi to inspire me. If it's a good sermon, if it's a good drasha, you know, then great. It'll never be a good drasha. I can tell you that for sure. Never. A person has to come and looking for the inspiration. I'm looking to find. If you're looking for inspiration, you'll find it anywhere. You can find inspiration if you're looking for it. You can find it even in the worst of the sermons. The best of the sermons will not inspire somebody who's not looking to be inspired. If a person comes and is not engaged, is not looking for it, it doesn't matter what you say. They're not interested. They're not looking. But if you're a Dorish, if you're seeking it out, you'll find it everywhere. You can find inspiration. You must. That's our obligation. As you can't wait for it to hit you, you must look to find it. You'll come there. I heard a beautiful pshat from the Imre Emes, was the son of the Svas Emes, the Ger Rebbe, who, I think I have that right, who noted L'shechno tidrishu, that when you should seek out his presence, is that in singular or in plural? L'shechno tidrishu. It's plural. Uvas ashama, and you will come there, is that singular or plural? That's singular. So he noted that's an interesting thing, that you have to, it's as if Moshe is speaking to all of us to seek it out, but come there, singular. So that's a beautiful explanation. Each one of us, he, the Imre Emes, understood how is it that we come to Hashem? It always has to be ki ish echad belev echad. It has to be unified. It has to be as one with achdus. Everybody has to seek. Everybody in their own way. You find what will be inspiring to you. You have to find Hashem. You must find His presence. Again, in the simple context of the meaning, it means in Yerushalayim. But in our lives, it means find God in our lives. You must find, in your own way, you have to find it. But when you actually want to come there, if you want to get there, you know how you get there? Then it's got to be tzezamen. It's got to be all together, all the Yidden, all the Jews feeling of biyachad as echad, and as a singular approach. Then you can have a nice thought from the Imre Emes. And then continuing pasuk vav, ve'veisem shama, we're going to go back to that pasuk in a moment. Ve'veisem shama, you will bring there all osechem and zivchechem, all of your offerings, and you will eat there before Hashem and enjoy with all the blessings that He will bestow upon you. And verse 8, Pasuk Ches, Lo tasun kuchol asher nachnu osim po hayom, not like what we do today, ish kol hayashar be'enam. Now everybody does what they want to do. Everybody in their backyard can set up their own altar, their own mizbeach, and do what they want. And now that we're crossing over, Moshe says, when we cross over that Yarden and we enter into the land of Israel, no more of this everybody doing what they want. Now there's going to be a singular, unifying place in Yerushalayim. That's the place that Hashem has chosen. You seek that out, and that's where you'll go to bring your offerings. Okay, that's the basics of the pasuk, beginning with the eradication of idolatry, and then don't do that to Hashem. Simple meaning of don't do that to Hashem is don't do that, meaning like what they do, setting up their gods wherever they want in all the beautiful places. You can only do that in Yerushalayim, in the place that He will choose. Rashi, on this pasuk of Lo Ta'asun Kain, brings two other explanations, besides for the simple one that we just said. Dover Acher, says Rashi, going back on the pasuk immediately preceding it. I just want to show what we did textually is the first verse that we read said, they set him up wherever they want. Then the verse said, you destroy them. Don't do that to Hashem. Now, if you read that linearly, when we said, don't do that to Hashem, that would be referring back to the most previous pasuk of destroy everything. But that doesn't make any sense. Don't destroy. So it means it's going back on the first verse. When it's a don't do that to Hashem, means setting up places of worship wherever you want. So it's skipping back a pasuk. Says Rashi, we can also interpret this as going back to the immediate pasuk. The immediate past pasuk said, destroy them and don't do that to Hashem. What do you mean, don't do that to Hashem? Says Rashi, it means this is the prohibition of mechikas Hashem. You're not allowed to erase God's name. Vilintotz even min mizbech min ha'azar, or to remove one of the stones from the azara, from the actual Beis HaMikdash, from the altar of the Beis HaMikdash, that you can't remove a stone from the Beis HaMikdash. That would be a form of, in the same way that we have to destroy the places of worship of the idolatrous practices, so you can't erase God's name or remove a stone of anything to do with the Beis HaMikdash. And so there is a form of lo ta'asun kein l'Hashem alokechem. Do not do the same. You're about to destroy that. Make sure you don't touch that. And this is what we know. Places have shuls have a shemos box for sidurim or chumashim. You can't just throw it out, because once it has God's name written on it, so we have a prohibition of you can't erase God's name. It has to be buried appropriately, and it comes out of this pasuk that after telling us to destroy the places of his idol worship, the next pasuk says, but don't do that to Hashem. Oh, I'm not allowed to do that. I have to be careful not to destroy anything, and included within erasing God's name is also removing anything to do with the azara, the place of the Beis HaMikdash.
Excuse me? Yeah. What about a kippah?
So a kippah does not have God's name on it. So it's just a religious article, meaning we wear it in a religious format, but it's really just a piece of cloth. It doesn't have...
And you can discard it?
Yeah, you can discard it when it's on people. It's a nice thing to wrap it in a bag so that it's not like in the garbage, like with the garbage, yeah. but to wrap it up in a plastic bag. But you can discard it because it doesn't have the sanctity of like a pair of tefillin or God's name on it. It's just, same thing with the tzitzit. You should wrap them up. You should wrap them up first. Some people like to bury them, but they don't have the sanctity of the written word, like tefillin and mezuzah. So okay, that changes. And as soon as you, if you put something on it, you can change it. But just the garment itself, once it becomes worn away, so you wrap it up.
Sometimes people feel ashamed.
Yeah, listen. If you want to bury, I think a lot of people bury the. You know, it's a chefsa shel mitzvah. It's an object that was used for a mitzvah. So it should be treated appropriately. It should be treated as used for a mitzvah. Certainly, once it becomes worn away, so but it should be wrapped. You should not just put it in a garbage. It should always be wrapped up.
But I think that tzitzit itself years ago we didn't throw out.
There's strings, yes. Cut them up.
Cloths. And put it in with
there are many levels in terms of how we deal with what we call tashmishe kedusha, things that we use for sanctity. In other words, a lulav is just a palm branch. We used it for a mitzvah. Right. But it's just a palm branch, but we use it for a mitzvah. So, therefore, we like to do another mitzvah with it. So, we use it to help burn the chametz, or you wrap it, same thing, you can just wrap it up. So, there are certain items which are just regular mundane items that we use for a mitzvah. Strings for a tzitzis, lulav, a shofar, all of those things are just regular mundane items that we use for a mitzvah. Then there are things which actually attain sanctity because psukim were like tefillin, mezuzah, they actually achieve a level of sanctity because of what, it's not just a regular item, we wrote things on it or use it in a way that achieves a higher, Sefer Torah. Sefer Torah is also just a piece of cow skin. But it's not just cow skin anymore because you wrote Hashem's name and it became a Sefer Torah. So those things there. So there are various levels of how we treat. Those things have to be buried. Okay, let's get back to Rashi. So explanation again. Explanation number one is don't do this Tashem, meaning don't set up your practice wherever you want, only centrally located in Yerushalayim. Explanation number two, Rashi says, is don't do this Tashem, meaning don't destroy the same way that you destroy the idolatrous practice. You can't do that to Hashem, meaning you can't erase his name, or you can't remove a stone from the complex of the Beis HaMikdash. The third comment Rashi makes is in the name of Rabbi Shmuel, who disagrees with that second comment. There's a prohibition, he says, of removing a stone from the Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Shmuel says, that can't be the pshat, that can't be the explanation. And his language is as follows, V'chisala al daitcha she Yisrael noitzenes ha-mizbechos? Would you think, would it enter your mind that a Jew would take away a stone from the Mizbeach? That we need a pasuk to say, don't do that to Hashem. You just destroyed the altars of the idolatrous practices. Don't destroy the altar of God. Don't take away, says Rabbi Shmuel, you need a verse to prohibit taking away a stone from the Mizbeach and the Beis HaMikdash. Would a Jew think of doing that? So he interprets it in a more homiletic drasha. He says, "Shelo tasu kimasehem." When the pasuk says, "Don't do this tashem," it means don't do things in your life that would cause you to be exiled and the Beis Hamikdash to be destroyed. Meaning, you have an obligation to destroy their altars. Don't do something which would cause God's altar to be destroyed. Not that you would do it yourself, says Rabbi Shmuel, because of course you wouldn't do that, but there are some other things you might like to do in life, and if you do those prohibited things, you know what the result of that's going to be? Tisha B'Av, and the Beis Hamikdash will be destroyed. So he darshins this pasuk of don't do this Tashem your God in a more homiletic drush away of don't, it's a warning. As you're destroying all their altars, watch yourself as you're destroying that you don't fall prey to something which will cause other enemies of the Jews to come and then do the same thing to Hashem's Beis HaMikdash, but that will be because of your actions. And so be careful not to do those. Those are the three explanations of the pasuk of Lo Ta'asun Kein Hashem. Do not do this to Hashem your God. Do not set up services of burning the incense or making offerings wherever you want, only in Yerushalayim. Or don't erase his name or remove a stone. Or don't behave in a way that would cause his Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed. So far, so good. One comment on the Maral, from the Maral. Maral comments on that last comment of Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel says, could it enter into a Jew's mind that he would take away a stone from the Beis HaMikdash? You don't need a pasuk for that. And that's why he interprets it in a more homiletic way of don't do behaviors. So the Maral asks on Rabbi Shmuel, what do you mean, would it enter your mind? We have many mitzvahs in the Torah that prohibit things which a person would never think of doing. And yet the Torah says, it's not allowed, so I tell you not to do it. For example, cursing God. It's called a Megadev. There's an entire series of psukim which describe the prohibition. Wouldn't you say the same thing? Would it enter into a Jew's mind to curse God? Like, would it enter into a Jew's mind to hit his parents? There are lots of things that people may think of. I don't know. Like, why? What do you mean, would it enter into such a person? The Torah gives us lots of halachas that may seem not relevant to us, and the Torah says it. So why is that such a strange thing that the Torah would have a prohibition of removing a stone?
Can you consider idolatry as being like Chokmat Yavan or some kind of foreign ideology?
Could be. Again, we're not here just talking about idolatry, we're talking about removing a stone from the Beis HaMikdash, specifically that. So the Maral says the following explanation. He says a very fascinating idea. He says, yes, there's a prohibition about cursing God also. So you could say the same way. He says, but the difference is, a person might curse God, it would be a gut reaction in a moment of anger or passion. Mm-hmm. That can happen to anyone at any time. And so the Torah says, don't do this behavior. You might ask, would a person do such a thing? The answer is, yeah. Yeah, a person can get caught up in a moment and can do all sorts of crazy. The Torah lists all, you can't do all these things.
Well,
removing a stone...
Can't or should not?
Can't.
No, it's not can't, it's should not. Should not.
I'm not...
You can do it, but you
correct,
should
yeah, I'm not having... Yeah, right.
You should not.
Right, yeah, I'm not talking about me like that's not physically impossible. Of course it's physically possible to do all these things. Removing a stone... If a person removed a stone from the Beis HaMikdash... Is that in a moment of rage, or would you have to plan out how am I going to get this stone out of the Beis HaMikdash? That's not a moment of anger or rage. That would be something. So to that, Rabbi Yishmael says, would a Jew premeditate going into the Beis HaMikdash to remove a stone? No, that he would never do. That's why Rabbi Shmuel comes on to the third homiletic explanation. But the idea of a Jew reacting in a certain way, which could be all sorts of bad things, that is certainly possible. Because when it comes to passion, anger, heat of the moment, then yes, all things are possible.
This makes a lot of sense. It speaks to me because of something I read just today. There was an article in Tablet about Elie Wiesel's night, and apparently there were many different formulations. And in some of the earlier formulations that were recently discovered, he actually curses God and, you know, becomes very angry about what happened, and that apparently those texts were somehow suppressed. I mean, it just shows you that it can happen.
Yeah, as we said many times, for sure it can happen. In that specific example, I would apply the edict which we've said many times. Ein mevi'in raya min a Holocaust. You can't ever prove anything or disprove anything from the Holocaust. That was an experience that was so beyond what any human can deal with that... correct. So we don't. Okay. In any case, that was all point number one. We have the idea of abolishing, removing, destroying all the idols. Lo tasun kein Hashem Elokeichem. Three explanations of what it means not to do that. Tasham, meaning not to set up places of worship wherever you want, or not to erase his name or remove a stone, or not to behave in a way that would cause his mizbeach to be destroyed by our enemies. I want to take a look quickly in our last 5 minutes at one other place in our parsha where Moshe describes or discusses idolatry, and that is in the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, page 1006. We'll do this as quickly as we can. Torah describes ki akum bekir b'chanovio cholom cholem chalom. You might have verse 2. You might have a prophet or a dreamer, and he will produce a sign or a wonder. Now, in the times of the Nevi'im, the times of the prophets, how did a person establish himself as a prophet? How did you prove? Well, you just walked into shul one day and said, "I'm a Navi." How did you establish yourself? So you needed to present or produce an oath or a mofes, a sign or a wonder. You needed to be able to do a wondrous act, a miraculous act, or predict the future in some way that would have otherwise been impossible to know, and it happens. And if you can prove that you're indeed a Navi through some wondrous a spiritual supernatural event, or predicting the future, then you establish yourself as a Navi. Once you're established as a Navi, now you have a special status amongst the Jewish people. A Navi, his job is to be a conduit between Hashem and the Jewish people, mostly to give us instruction, rebuke, warning, whatever the case may be. On occasion, a Navi was allowed to suspend Torah law. We have a number of instances throughout Jewish history where a prophet would suspend the halachas of the Torah in a specific instance. For example, Eliyahu HaNavi, when he was dealing with the idolatrous practice of the Baal, offered up a korban outside of the Beis HaMikdash. When he did the whole test, you'll do your thing, I'll do my thing, we'll see which from where the fire descends from heaven. He's technically not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to bring an offering outside of the Beis HaMikdash. But as a prophet, he was allowed to establish that that's what we were going to do. Mordechai, in the Pesach story, when Esther's getting ready to go into Achashverosh, it was over, the first time was over Pesach, 11 months, right? And what did we do that first Pesach? Everybody was fasting for the 3 days, and nobody ate matzah on Pesach. How did he have a right to do that? So a Navi has a right to suspend a mitzvah in the Torah. That happens numerous different times. There are two requirements to a Navi, again, first three things really. Number one is you have to establish yourself as a Navi. You have to be a proven Navi through some miraculous supernatural event. Number two, the suspension of the mitzvah can only be temporarily. If a Navi were to come and say, this mitzvah doesn't apply anymore at all, ever, then you know that he's a false prophet. A Navi could never permanently abolish any mitzvah in the Torah. He was only allowed to, for a moment, for a temporary event, stop or add or do something, but never on a permanent basis. The third requirement is it can never be in regards to idolatry. If a Navi ever were to say, it's now okay to worship this idol or serve this god or do it, even temporarily, then you know he's a false prophet immediately. So he has to prove himself a Navi. It must be on a temporary way, and it can never be in regards to idolatry. If it's ever in regards to idolatry, then you know he's immediately a false prophet and do away with him. That comes from the pasuk that we're about to read. If the Navi or dreamer will come and he will produce an os or a mofes, uvaha os vaha mofes asher diber lacha, and it comes true what he said was going to happen, And he says, this prophet, Nilcho acharei Elohim acharim asher lo yida'atom v'na'avdeim. And his prophecy is, let's go follow after other gods that your fathers didn't know, your forefathers didn't know. That's my message to you as a prophet. Now, what do you do? He's proven himself to be a prophet. What he said was going to happen, happened. But now he's telling you to worship something else. Lo tishmal divrei anaviyahu alachalom achalom. You're not allowed to listen to him. Ki minaseh Hashem elokeichem eschem. Lada, Hashem is testing you. Not only he's testing you. Ladas hayishchem oyhavim es Hashem elokeichem v'chol levavchem v'chol nafshchem. To see whether or not you love Hashem, your God, with all your heart and with all of your soul. Now, we really need more time for this, but just very quickly. There are two approaches in the Gemara as to how to understand this. The first approach of the Gemara is Rabbi Yossi Haglili, which is the simple reading of the Psukim. A person came, predicted the future, predicted supernatural events, and they came true. They happened. Miracles happened. And then he told you to serve another God. Why would Hashem let that happen? How Hashem let these miracles happen? So the Pasuk says, to test you whether or not you love Hashem, your God. That's Rabbi Yossi's approach.
He's saying that you should serve other gods. Doesn't he get...
Yeah, he gets killed. Yeah, he gets a serious slap. There's a Navi Sheker. Rabbi Akiva says, it can't be the meaning of the pasuk. It can't be that Hashem would perform miraculous events, supernatural events, for a false prophet. It can't be. For a false prophet who wants it. So he reads the psukim as, this false prophet predicted things or did miraculous events in the past to establish himself as a valid prophet. And now, after establishing himself as a valid prophet, now he turns and says, let's follow idolatrous practices. Do not listen to him. This is a test. So two approaches. Whether or not he's actually producing the wonders and miracles now while he's prophesizing for idolatry, and the test is to still say, but you're telling me to do idolatry, I can't. Or Hashem would never allow for that. It must be that he turned on himself at some point, that he had been a true prophet. But again, just remember what that means. Remember the type of stature of person who we're talking about, who was a Navi. And then that person who's been an established Navi for months or years, one day comes and says to do idolatry. Do you know how tempting that would be for most of the common folk? I just need to finish the thought. To say, who's the one telling me to do this? It's not a nobody.
Not my fault.
This is the Gadol Hador. This is a prophet. It's a test. As soon as he tells you, idolatry. Now, the last thing that I'll mention is before I have to go and finish up. If you have to finish the sentence, this is a test. God is testing you to see whether or not you love him, fear him. Which one would you finish that sentence? God is testing you by sending a prophet, either like Rabbi Yossi Haglili, who right now is performing miraculous events and telling you to serve other gods, or like Rabbi Akiva, who had been your prophet for years, who brought you, grew you, raised you, inspired you, and now, it's a test. Something happened to him. Is that to find out whether or not you fear God, or whether or not you love God? How would you have concluded that? So it's an interesting thing, isn't it, that the Torah says this is to see whether or not you love Hashem, your God. Not whether or not you fear Him, but whether or not you love Him will give you the strength. That's going to be the test to withstand such a test of such a prophet, a false prophet, telling you to serve other gods. And you have every reason to believe him. Except the Torah says, if he's telling you to serve other gods, he's a false prophet. Don't ever listen to him. That's a testimony to how much love you would have for Hashem, not how much you fear him. It seems to me that if it's only a measure of how much you fear him, this would be a reason to follow after the prophets. But if you love Hashem, your God, then you'll be able to withstand that challenge, which is just a fascinating insight. There's more to say, but we're out of time. We will pick up Mirtz Hashem next week. Have a wonderful rest of your day and rest of your week.
If you fear someone, it's the way it's